Just like a vercha, side point over here, but question was raised by Leonard, is there any sin that God will never forgive a person for?
Yeah.
And Teddy made a very astute observation that it's a didn't do tshuva or not. Teddy always, the answer was that only those that he didn't do tshuva for. So then we simply said that it is a, when we speak about tshuva, we have to speak it in two frameworks. One is within the framework of this world, our existence in this world, which is the prozor, the empty chamber. And with regard to that too, there's a whole system of sin, and man has a relationship with God which affects his status and his standing in this world relative to the hashkacha of God. And there's a whole system when a person sins of how he can be pardoned and reinstate his relationship with God. Okay, now with regard to that system, there are certain sins that he can never be pardoned for in terms of his existence in this world, and that is Chil Hashem, desecration of the name of God. However, with regard to eternal man's capacity for eternal existence, that is the goal for which you should really aspire and ascribe to. The Rambam says that any sin, no matter the worst sin, the person was a sinner all of his life, and even if he was a heretic, apikoros, avodah zarah, which we're talking about really the worst sins, and of course, to a certain extent, they also partake of Chil Hashem. He says, even if he was a sinner all of his days, if he did tshuva on his deathbed, so then he, genuine tshuva on his deathbed, so then he has a share in the world to come. Of course, it should be understood that that's all we're saying, is that he has a share. But that's another thing a person should consider, that it's a small chela. Because the extent to which a person partakes of Olam Haba is subject to degree, and an intelligent person would want to live his life in such a way that he partakes to the highest level. Okay, now the question has come up, what about this idea that if a person has been a rusher all of his life and in the end of his days he does tshuva, it's not so easy to understand logically why that should be so. Why that should cancel out an entire life of sin. Okay. Then the question was raised, what about Nazis, or what about Hitler? Suppose Hitler did tshuva. Okay. Now, Hitler and Lashma, of course. Now, Leonard said that that's an impossibility. By definition, he's lost his capacity. The tshuva, because he's essentially an animal. And then however, Lenny is saying, okay, that it's true, it's this phenomenon that since a person does possess a divine soul, that he can reach a level where he basically loses his divine soul, so to speak. To me, this is the case of Yiparo. That's the case of the Torah. The case of the Paro, that the Rambam, well, that's the Machlokas, that Paro. Clearly a Machlokas among the Mepharshim, but the Rambam maintains that the Mani Akshat Libo, that I will harden his heart.
Yeah.
And that means to say that a person can reach a certain level wherein he no longer partakes of the capacity for Bechira, that the God deprived him of his capacity for Bechira, and that's the course, that's the ultimate punishment. That is the ultimate punishment. I mean, because then he no longer has the capacity to function as a true human being. So, but that seems to be a rare case. Okay, it seems to be a rare case. I don't know how many other cases. I'm not. You know, Teddy mentioned the case of Yeravam. Yeravam was given a choice. That's true. Chazal says that when Yeravam was the king who was responsible for breaking and dividing the kingdom after the death of Shlomo, and Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, became the successor. But he made mistakes. And Yeravam was a big Talmud Chacham, and he had served under Shlomo and so forth, but he initiated a revolt, and he set up his own Malchus, then in order to prevent the people from going back to Yerushalayim for the Regalim, he started to make the changes in Halacha. He set up Bamal. He set up altars and Avodah Zarah. Basically he reintroduced Avodah Zarah. An interesting Chazal that at the beginning, before he had become firmly entrenched in faith, so the Chazal would say that God came to your Rebbe. Interesting Chazal, see how you would interpret it. God came to your Rebbe and said to him, Chazor b'tshuva. Return yeshuva. Vani uven yishai. And I, and Ben Yishai, that's Dov HaMelech, and you will be Natayo in Gan Eden. We'll walk together in Gan Eden. Okay? Don't take it literally. It's not a physical phenomenon. Okay?
Whatever it means.
It means you partake, whatever you are, you'll partake of the ultimate bliss. Because that's what it means. That it means to say like this, that that's the essence of Olam Haba. What is the goodness of Olam Haba? What is the bliss? It is with regard to the closeness to God. In other words, the objective of life is to have a certain relationship with God. And the limited, of course, in physical world, physical existence. But Olam Haba, it removes a tremendous veil, tremendous barrier, and that's what Chazal say, Tzadikim Yoshim, because you can sit there and their crowns are on their heads. And then in Mizrav Hashchina, there are plenty of pleasure from the glow of the Shchina, so to speak. Of course, we don't even understand this. We're just taught to use these words because they immediately translated into a physical type of thing. But it means to say that as a person gets a greater knowledge of God, greater closeness of God, so that's an increase in his bliss. So that was a pretty good offer. Right? That was a pretty good offer. So what did he respond? So the Rebbe answers, he meant, who will be at the head? Not referring to God, in other words. God, of course, is in a different category. He didn't mean that, but in terms of him and the Ben Yishai, who's the Rosh? Who's at the head? So God answers, Ben Yishai Barosh. Ben Yishai Barosh? No, because that's the, whatever, it doesn't explain to you exactly what they're referring to, but that's the premier kingship, the ultimate kingship is really Ben Yishai. But Mashiach is going to be from David, and David HaMelech, and David was Zocha, and he was Zocha for all his descendants, and that's the real kingship. Every other kingship is really just temporary. There can be other kings according to the Rambam, but it's just temporary, it won't last. The dynasty won't last throughout history, but the ultimate kingship, which will finally eventuate in the Mashiach, is Ben Yishai. So he answered him, in Cain, Lo. If that's the case, then he has won. Sorry, the thing is like this, to be in such company, whatever it entails, it's not clear, whatever it entails, in certain recognition, in terms of his status, in terms of his stature, in terms of his relationship with God. So you say, so what's so terrible? I mean, it's a tremendous thing. But it means that if a person, meaning of that Chazal is like this, what Chazal is telling you is that if a person's whole essence is all from ego, then you can never be satisfied with second place. Okay? Most people, when they hear that, they say, well, they can't believe it. How much is a person, I'd be satisfied with that. What's wrong with second place? In that type of company. But that's only because you're not involved in that area. But a person that's involved in the area, the second place is insufficient. He said, he came over email. He said, who leave her up? In other words, he's willing to be chazar b'tshuva. He's willing to embrace the true ideas. But that's only if it satisfies a certain emotional need. Okay? So he says, leave her up. So once he heard that if he's chazar b'tshuva, then he will be. Forget all this. You see, he was attracted to the spiritual benefits. Otherwise, God wouldn't have made him the offer. And otherwise, he wouldn't have answered me, Barosh. Because what's the difference in Barosh if you're not interested in doing tshuva altogether? You see? So it wasn't that he couldn't relate to the benefits, to the true benefits. But the problem was he needed to satisfy his ego. So God was offering him a compromise. God was offering him a compromise. It wasn't demanding that he give up his entire need for ego satisfaction. That wasn't being demanded of him. All it meant was that he had to subdue it and control it and satisfy it on a different level. That was the choice. But his answer was, me barosh, that is to say that I cannot have it that way. And it's all or nothing. And if you say then Yishai is barosh, so then he doesn't want it. And can't love him. That's the basic idea of Hazal. It's easy for people to be philosophical about somebody else's emotions. That's the way they intend to be. I can't believe, and you know, he's so wealthy, I can't believe he got into trouble over that crazy deal. What does he need? You know, it's very easy. You say it's very easy when a person is not, I mean, it's important, you know, because when you're not caught up in the emotion yourself, so then you look at things rationally. So, you know, it's easy to be philosophical about somebody else's emotions. All the mistakes that people make, and all when they abandon philosophy and just follow their emotions, just because it's their own emotions, and that's just, then it has an emotional effect upon them. That's why it's good when you're in a situation like that to go to a chaver. That's the idea of having a chaver who's honest and doesn't partake of the same emotions in the situation. So he can be objective. That's what you need. That's the idea of a chaver, really. Because it's very difficult to be objective about your own situation because you're involved and you have the emotions. The only thing is, most people can't recognize that. And they have to start to overestimate their own powers. They think they're so wise, or they actually do more than that. They ascribe a certain they ascribe a certain wisdom to their own emotions and instincts. They begin to follow their feelings. They begin to have that sense of being more than that, not just righteous, but more than that in terms of all knowing. In other words, like, that's when people make mistakes. What happens? Well, a lot of people you have to deal with the world of reality. You have to use his faculties, his mind, and you have to be careful. You can't just follow his instincts. You have to go to experts. But the problem is, then you see when a person reaches a certain level of success, he no longer follows the same methodology. Then he begins to make impulsive decisions, intuitive, you know, and so forth. Then he negates the experts. He was successful not because of any innate superiority or innate wisdom. It's because he followed the proper methodology. But then when he reaches a certain point, it goes to his head. He wants to take credit for something where he doesn't have that. And then he begins to have this feeling of being all-knowing. Like he's inherently got some automatic insight, so to speak. That's when he begins to make mistakes. It seems to be, Leonard again is asking a question. We're making a statement that is to say that a person should not think of the reward that he's going to get. It's a lower level. That a person who's, every time he does a mitzvah, is thinking about the reward that he's going to get, would seem to be at a lower level. Rather, he should only think that he's doing it because God commanded him. That's true. It seems to be true. That's what the Rambam says. That's the Rambam in Perek Yud of Hilchos Teshuva. Al Yomar Adam, a person should not say, Haveni Osem Mitzvos HaTorah, I am going to do the mitzvah of the Torah, the Osek B'Chachmasa, and immerse myself in its wisdom. Today, Shakabel Kalabrachos HaTzuvos Ba, in order to receive all the brachos that are written there. Okadesha Eskel HaChayom Ba, or in order to merit the life of the world to come. That's interesting. In other words, well, the brachos that are written there is a reference to the brachos in this world, the blessings in this world. But that a person should not say that he's going to do the mitzvot in order to receive those blessings. Or beyond that, that he'll merit the life of the world to come. The Ephrosh min Haveros says, he return my hand, and I'll avoid the Averos that the Torah has warned us against, Kidei She'enotel Menachlolos HaKsubis Torah, in order to be saved from the curses, the punishments that are written in Torah. Kidei Shalal Ikareis Michayel Mabah, or that I shouldn't be cut off from the life of Olam Haba. Ein roi la'avodas Hashem al derech hazeh. It's not fitting to serve God in this way. She'oved al derech zeh, because one who serves God in this way, who obeyed me'ira, he's serving out of fear. Ve'ena malas ha'neviyim. This is not the level of the neviyim, v'lo malas ha'chacham, nor is it the level of the chacham. Ve'ein ovdim Hashem al derech zeh, ela amei ha'aretz. And the only ones who serve God in this way are the people who are lacking in knowledge, v'hanashim v'aktanim, or women and children, shemachanchan osan lava v'yira. We use this method, he says. We endorse this method only as tachinuch, to serve God v'yira, ad shetir b'daitan, until their knowledge, their wisdom increases, v'yavdu me'ava, and they serve from Ava. So that seems to be correct. The interesting thing is that from a practical standpoint, it seems that most people, most religious people, do serve God on this basis. If you remove that factor, from an emotional standpoint, practically speaking, if you could do a poll and people were honest, it would turn out, in my opinion, that that's clearly the motivating factor: fear. Fear.
Fear to commit sin.
No, fear to be punished. Fear to be fear. Fear of punishment and fear of destruction. The desire for Olam Haba is not really because of the true good of Olam Haba. It's because man has an instinct for immortality, so he associates that with Olam Haba. So there's a fear of death, fear of destruction, fear of death. That seems, that's what the Rambam is talking about. It's all fear.
So we don't know what the
thing is. Like this is that you're saying over here that a person should not consider the schar, the reward of the mitzvah. He rather should only be doing it because it is the will of God. But Chazal, Max is saying, seems to be saying something differently. And they're based on the pasuk of V'chein Yomu Hamoshlam Bo Cheshbon. So it's a drasha. It's not the plain meaning, obviously, but it's an allusion to an idea that come and make a cheshbon, that a person should always use his intellect to save him from sin, and he should always make a cheshbon. And that is that he should consider the schar of the mitzvah kineged hafseda, or the schar he should always compare, the schar, the benefit he intends to get from the avera, from the gratification of the instinct, contrasting it with the loss, in other words, in terms of mitzvah. You won't get the schar of the mitzvah, and so on and so forth. A person should think along those lines, and in this way he'll be saved from doing an avera. So you see from this that a person should always consider, it should always be in the forefront of his mind when he's doing a mitzvah. He should be very cognizant of schar mitzvah. If a person doesn't have a concept of schar mitzvah, so then he's going to be destroyed by by his inclination. It's the contrary. I mean, of course you could try and answer by saying that really a person should not consider the reward. The only thing is that when he's overcome by his emotions, he's not operating on a proper level, so now you have to use a lowlishma kind of a thing. Right? But I still maintain the question. That's my first thought to get out of it. But I don't know if that's true, because that presupposes, it does presuppose a reality of schar mitzvah, to negative seda. And if a person doesn't have such a concept, so then he's just going to be vulnerable to the Yetzer Hara. And what's he supposed to do in the Yetzer Hara? There will be times in a person's life when the Yetzer Hara will overcome him. So I think there's a different answer. In other words, I don't think there's really a contradiction. There's an apparent contradiction, but I don't think there really is. If you go to a deeper level, I think that what the Rambam is saying over here doesn't mean that a person should not take cognizance of schar mitzvah. The Rambam is not, in my opinion, not saying that. See, what the Rambam is talking about over here, the lowlishma, what the Rambam is talking about over here, means to say that that's a completely distorted view of Torah. The Rambam really puts it down. It's a very aimroy. It's not even a fit way to serve God. When you think about it, it is not a fit way to serve God. speaks about it very disparagingly. See? And I don't think that what Chazal is saying in a situation where a person is overcome by temptation that he should revert back to this level to combat the Avera. Although if a person did so, I'm not saying, you know, if he didn't, if this is the type of thinking that saved him from Avera, so fine. But I don't think that's what Chazal is talking about. Now the reason why this is at a very low level, why is it such a low level? What's so terrible about it? That a person fears God, he serves God out of fear. Because he does believe, it does indicate a belief in God, in God's power, and that God has total control over his fate. So since he recognizes that God has total control out of his fate, over his fate, and he doesn't want to have bad things happen to him, he doesn't want to have good things happen to him, so he serves God. But by the way, is this basically the reason why most of the shuls are filled on Shabbos? Am I wrong? Am I missing something?
How about
right? You don't think so? I mean, you talked about the overwhelming majority of the Frum, the Frum people, or even the non-Frum, I mean religious. As long as a person identifies as being religious in some type of a way, in which he does certain religious activities, which in his mind are serving God, am I wrong? If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But that's the correct attitude of this phenomenon. And that is to say, that a person shouldn't start to look down on people that partake of this. First of all, we all partake of it to a certain extent. And the extent to which we can truly free ourselves from this type of service is limited. I mean, we're supposed to elevate, but the Rambam says that when your knowledge increases, I mean, we tend to read it and we say that, because the Rambam is on an extremely high level. So he's saying that this is only for the ignoramuses and for women and children. And that doesn't mean to say people that are lacking knowledge until they reach the level. But everybody's mechuyev to get themselves out of that framework, to rise to a higher level. I think, though, that when you take that to the practical level, you have to have a certain element of realism over here, and that is to say that it's not so pushy. And that we can strive, we have to follow the pattern, we can strive to elevate ourselves, to extricate ourselves from being caught up in this type of a phenomenon, but the extent to which we can truly do so, the extent to which we can eliminate that factor of serving God, shalolishma, and moving to the level of serving God out of love is not so easy. And there too, the important word is there's different levels, and it's a very long and slow process. And a person shouldn't just simply disparage it. A person shouldn't disparage it because even as he advances, he still has certain emotions that are playing an important role. You don't know the full extent of the psyche. So when you're dealing with people too, you have to realize there are certain forces, psychological forces that are responsible for keeping them observant. And if you should tamper with them when they're not ready to move to the next level, you can bring about great harm to them. So this is a word of caution. Okay. The way I always ask the question is, what's wrong with it? I mean, is it true or is it false? The Torah does say that you'll have these rewards. The Torah does say that you'll have these punishments. The Yad is just that there's an Olam Haba. So these are things that we should want. What's wrong with it? What's so terrible about it? I mean, the Torah, if the Torah didn't say it, they were true, and I was making it up. So you say, you're living in a fantasy. It's not true. But if the Torah itself tells me that it's true, that if you serve me, I will give you the rains and the seasons and so on and so forth, and if you rebel against me, you'll be punished and so on and so forth, then there must be a reason why the Torah is telling it to me. So the rational person learns the lesson. If a rational person gets on the program, so to speak. And that's, I don't want these bad things, I do want these good things, and the way to do it is by serving God, so serve God. I mean, what the Rambam disparages is, and brings it down to a very low level. The Torah doesn't seem to be teaching that way. You read the Shema. In other words, but the Torah does, if you're going to say that a person that functions this way is preoccupied with himself, I don't see what's wrong with that. What else is a person supposed to be preoccupied with? But one second, let me just make my point is that, but if the Torah, if that were true, the Torah doesn't want a person to be concerned about these types of things, so why is the Torah promising you all these things? This Rambam seems to be flying in the face of the Torah. The Torah seems to be saying you should be concerned about these things. Otherwise, why would the Torah warn you that I'll give you the rains and the seasons and this and that and everything will work out perfectly? I mean, if these are things I shouldn't be concerned about altogether because I shouldn't be thinking about my needs, so why is the Torah constantly throwing it in my face?
No,
I'm trying to say it like this. What's happening is that there's two things going on there. there is a like many things. For example, there is a reality, there is a truth over here, and the truth that the Shema is teaching us is that God is Mashiach, the divine providence rules the world, and ultimately, what a person experiences in this life, this whole situation, is dependent upon the will of God. And that's something, of course, that a person has to take cognizance of. But that doesn't mean to say that that is the motivating force behind your service of God. A person who is motivated, you see, what the Rambam really is talking about over here is that very fundamental primal religious instinct. This is the primal religious instinct. This is what creates religion. All religions are the same. Religions are founded upon man's essential insecurity. And he finds himself bewildered by the forces around him, the forces of nature, reality, human society, and so forth. It's too overwhelming. And he feels he feels insecure. He can't make it. He can't make it. And more than that, I mean, even with regard to the immediate, he has a certain need for infinite, you know, for eternal existence. And there too, he senses his weakness, fear of death. Fear of death plays a tremendous role. For most people, that's why. The most important religious observance for most people is the Kaddish. It's the Yahrzeit. That's something that people go crazy for. People that don't put on film, don't keep Shabbos, etc. They'll drive to Shul.
They'll drive to Shul.
They'll drive to
Shul.
That becomes the Holy of Holies. The thing is, that is a very powerful instinct, but it's a completely distorted picture. It means to say that a person, in terms of what he values, what he's striving for, is really focused on the wrong. He's materialist. He's essentially a materialist. And his life is basically, it's based upon catering to all. It's not because it's selfish. It's not really, in truth, it is not selfish, because it's not in terms of his best interest. His best interest is to cater to that part of him which is really partakes of the divine, the neshama, the telem olam. That's what he should be working on. That's real selfishness. True selfishness means he's really working in terms of obtaining the real good for man. The real good for man is not the instinctual. So this person who is simply turning to God, he's trying to use God as a vehicle for satisfying the lower part of him and deflecting him from the true good. That's low ishma. Well, it's not Yadav, it's not Judaism. That's not what the system is all about. There is truth. He's taking the truth. The truth is that God's Mashiach, and God works out the world in such a way that the righteous are rewarded and then the sinners are punished, and that's because of God's system, so that the righteous can find what they need in order to obtain the true good, so that they'll have the best life in this world in order to obtain the true good of Olam Haba. That's the real reason why God orders it this way. That's the real reason of Chavionis. Not because of the way you imagine it, in your primitive way, that if you're a good boy, I mean, you're projecting, you know, you're projecting all the emotions that come from the parental situation onto God. You're making God into the good father and the punishing father. It's a total distortion of God. It's a total distortion of life. It's a total distortion of the good. That's why it's a very low level. It disparages it. It's true, of course. Chavionis is true, but not the way you imagine it. In the framework of the primitive religious imagination. So that's why this is no good. But that is not to say that a person should not be cognizant of Schar Mitzvah. True Schar Mitzvah. There's a true Schar Mitzvah. Every mitzvah, when a person is involved in it properly and studies it, it leads to a perfection of the individual in accordance with true perfection, the perfection of the soul. Every mitzvah has a benefit, a reason, a purpose, and as a person gains knowledge, he begins to see that this is the true way of life. This is the real good for man. And then he has a sense of Schar Mitzvah. I don't think there are any Chazal there saying Schar Mitzvah in a primitive way, that you'll get the rains in the season if you do this. Because when a person is in a situation where he's overcome by lust, by taivas, he wants the opposite of the taivas. So what are you going to tell him? That give up your tithe, you'll get a better reward? This is, it doesn't make sense that they're referring to this. Because when a person's overcome by desire and he has an object in front of him, that's what he wants. I mean, yes, I'm living for tithe, but now you're going to tell him no. Give that up and go back to the system and you'll get a bigger reward. But what'll be the bigger reward? This is this for him right now. This is what I want. It's not going to work. But if the person has reached a certain level, this presupposes, that Chazal presupposes, both Cheshbon presupposes a certain level of a Gavra that realizes that Yah, this is really a system of perfection. It's not just religious, primitive religious observances that have some effect upon God, a mystical, like a voodoo system. That's what most people view, like you're doing every mitzvah has a certain power to affect the cosmos. It's like a very kind of an anthropomorphic thing. No, but the mitzvah that given purely from man, and he can see the benefit. You can see. That's the whole point. That's a very essential point. Most people don't believe that mitzvah is such a thing where you can see the benefit. They believe it has some sort of benefit that you can see. It's a cosmos, and the cosmos, it effectuates, it creates angels and so on and so forth, and it brings about results purely in terms of the physical situation. No, the cheshbon is for an individual who already has gone beyond this point, and he's already experienced the phenomenon of schar mitzvah. He's seen in his own life how when he performs and he gives up, he's able to overcome an instinct, and he can redirect the energies to a higher good, and he gives up instant gratification, then in the long run he achieves a different type of happiness than he would have had he given into the immediate instinct. So that's the schar mitzvah. The schar mitzvah is in terms of be selfish in terms of Torah's appealing to the individual now in the framework of selfishness, because he's been overcome, he's being affected by a tremendous temptation. But then at least use your intelligence and be able to get beyond that and think down the road. Don't just think of the immediate, think about the long range effect down the road. What's the ultimate benefit from this indulgence? It's going to lead to hefted. It's an immediate gratification which leads to hefted. On the other hand, the mitzvah may be a momentary deprivation which leads to a great improvement. That's what it's saying. Baruch Heshbon, use your mind, use your intelligence. You can't fight this war if you're not going to use your intelligence. But that presupposes that there's a phenomenon of Schar Mitzvah. But that's not that Schar Mitzvah. That's a whole different system already. That means that the system is really, the mitzvah is really a system of rational ideas which are based upon directing you towards a better way of living. And the tzaddik, that's the idea of Asherecha Ba'olam Hazeh, that the tzaddik has a better life in this world. He really partakes of a better existence in this world. And of course, as a natural result, it leads to the Olam Haba. That's the idea. So there's absolutely no contradiction between the two. Here the Rambam is saying that a person should not be rooted in primitive religious emotionalism, which distorts the Torah and takes what the Torah is talking about, that God does reward the righteous, in the wrong way. He simply co-opts that idea into his materialistic system. And that's false. A person shouldn't serve God in that way. It's not even a service of God. It's not a service of God. But the Torah tolerates it because it's the foundation. Since we're all instinctual beings, there has to be a certain foundation. Otherwise, a person wouldn't be attracted to Torah in the first place. Yeah. However, what Chazal is saying in Baruch Heshbon is a different level. It means it shows you perfectly that that's the complement. It complements this by telling you that mitzvot is really a system in which there is a schar, but the true schar of the mitzvah is that it perfects you, it raises you to a higher level and brings you closer to God. But that's a tangible benefit which you experience the benefits of that in this world. We're not saying it's like therefore there's no benefit. There's no benefit. It's just because I'm doing it because God told me, like it's simply a blind, I'm obedient to God, and I don't need a reward. I just serve God. That's not a proper way of putting it. There are the tangible benefits, but there are better benefits of a different kind, different type of an enjoyment. The Torah of what about the enjoyment of Torah? The enjoyment of learning. The whole concept of serving God with simcha. Where does that come from?
It's
something which is perceived. Every benefit that man has in this world is perceived by the emotion. It's an emotion, but that emotion is a totally different type of an emotion, of happiness, rather than the one, as opposed to the one that comes from simply following the life of love. I don't mean to say that the person serves God and there's no emotion of happiness attached to it. Other than the idea that I've been obedient. That's not the case. The whole idea of the Torah Lishma, is that one derives the greatest enjoyment that a person can obtain in this world. Okay. The true experience of Torah knowledge, Torah insight, of knowledge, that's an enjoyment. to be able to partake of Ne'er, the Rambam says it's a Ne'er. But the very service of God has to be a service of joy. How do you understand that? What's the joy? What is the joy?
Can you serve God?
Asking a question with regard to what we said regarding tshuva. But the Rambam makes it very clear that there is no other at all that tshuva cannot atone for. And the sense in which the Rambam meant it, atoning for it, with regard to the state of the soul in Olam Haba. That is to say, the Rambam says that the worst rush, even if it's a rush upon your own, is obviously as long as he is good tshuva, even on his last day, even on his deathbed, I mean, assuming it's a good tshuva, which that is not so simple. I mean, you can't just pick it as you went through the motion because, he knows his Rama. He's using the loophole for it, but it can't be, that's not what he means. No, that's not what he means. That's why somebody said that it's hard to conceive of something like that. I agree. First, if you know how the human psyche operates, and it's not that simple. People don't think of it that way. If a person that's in Russia is living according to a certain sense of what's right and what's wrong, and he's rationalized everything, and he's not a person who's really self-critical. He lacks any type of honesty about himself. So you have to understand that type of phenomenon, it's not going to happen. It could happen, but it's very unlikely that it's going to happen. Let's put it that way. It's very unlikely. I agree with that point. But it's very unlikely because if you know the nature of the psyche, especially the psyche of the Russia, the Russia is a strong-willed individual. And these tatlik are up. I mean, he has a very strong sense of certainty about his way of life, in spite of the fact that it's totally false. But his attitude towards it, and his attitude towards the truth, is very strong. It's not like he's not a weak-minded person that now that he's dying, he's going to do 180-degree turn. So it's a very unlikely thing. That's why he mentioned a person like Hitler a lot from now. And he's right, that Lenin said this, that it's inconceivable that he would do a tshuva on his deathbed. That is true from a psychological standpoint. Yeah, but... As also that, Hashem, Asul, Al Tikre, Yehem, Enem, Oz, and Tshuva. What does that mean? What's the essence of a Rasha? The essence of a Rasha makes basically everybody has emotions. Pull them in a certain direction. But as long as the reality principle remains intact, so then a person can see that his way is failing. I mean, there for sure, you can go back to reality. He hasn't destroyed the reality principle of him. He sees it's not working, it doesn't make sense. But just in a practical way. Aside from the philosophical, but in a practical way. So he hurts people, so then people are angry. And when things begin to fall apart, he loses his friends, he loses his relationships, whatever. Then he could stop and think that maybe there's something wrong over here. So that's the point, that Rishai, the essence of a Rasha, is someone who's completely removed himself from the framework of reality. That's why Asul of Tisrei Gehenim, even Tisrei Gehenim, in a sense, means that everything's falling apart. And it's interesting, you see that in the case again of Hitler and Rashma, it's very interesting. It's very interesting, you see that everything is falling around. The worse things got, he had to retreat, the more crazy he became. Total denial in the bunker. So he began to, he had all these kind of crazy plans, sending out this, putting this ragtag on it, to get this one, and we're going to invade over here. And he had, that's just like Adam, in my opinion. It doesn't necessarily have to mean, what people refer to as something beyond this world. No, just like Adam is an expression that even when everything is falling apart, and really in a concrete kind of a way, because the Russia may deny the abstract reality, but he's living what he maintains is the physical reality, the sensual reality. But even when the world of the senses falls apart, it's one thing to do tshuva because you realize when you think about it, it's not just what I'm doing, it's not just. Even if it's succeeding, a person is really do tshuva even if he's successful. The guy's bankrupt and he's pulling up his house. He should be able to sit down with him and show him that he's completely unjust. And what you're doing is really harmful to the soul because you're acting in an unjust manner. And you're, you know, feeling yourself is wrong, even though it's acceptable. It's really the way a person shouldn't have to be chewed because he got caught by the cop. Now I understand that feeling is wrong. It's not because that doesn't show that feeling is wrong, it just shows that it's not practical. So the Russia really is living in the world of the practical, denying a reality outside of the physical. In order for a person to do the truth of the abstract truth, he has to acknowledge that there's a another dimension of reality outside of the physical. That's essentially what the Russia is. The Tzaddik is the person who's not living in the world. For him, the physical is really an expression of something beyond. He's concerned about the abstract world, the world beyond the physical. That's why he's concerned about whether something is just or unjust. Whether it succeeds, of course he maintains that ultimately that which is just will succeed is the most successful, you know, the most practical in this world as well. That's not the primary concern. The primary concern is not really success in the physical world. And the Russia, however, is only concerned for him the reality, the only reality that he acknowledges is the reality of the concrete, particularly the physical. So that's why, I mean, he'll adopt the third path if it's successful, and he's only concerned about success. Now, the thing is that even in that area, he's not living, you see, once he denies reality, he's not living in the realm of reality, he's not living in the realm of truth, so then even when the phenomena in the world of the concrete go against him, even then he'll deny it. He'll deny the physical reality. He'll distort and deny the physical reality. That's a philo pissed like Gehenna, because he's so tied in with his own egotistical view of things. His view of reality is so tied in with his own self, you know, his own ego, that he can't even submit to any level of objectivity, even in the physical. A philo pissed like Gehenna made him most in Shiva, they don't get Shiva. Because once they become committed to a certain position of the ego, that's it. They can't free themselves from that. However, so what is the Rambam saying? And what's the Rambam saying? The Rambam is not interested in conveying a practical point. The truth of the matter is that not every Russia is the same. There's different degrees of Russian, and the phenomenon is possible. We maintain that it's possible. Of course, you're talking about somebody, you know, like Hitler, you're talking about someone like Tara, you're talking about a certain level of rishis where it's not feasible anymore. But the Rambam is talking about a situation when we are rishayim, people are rishayim, there's a whole category in it. It embraces a huge category of people will fall under that heading. You know what I mean? Like, a person's a Russian, he's a Russian. You don't have to be a Russia like Hitler to get into the club. That's what he's talking about. That even you have to understand that the Rambam is teaching us a philosophical principle about the power of tshuva. We're not interested in particular individuals. You see? Of course, I mean, the Rambam wouldn't tell you this principle in the Mishnah Torah if it was completely impossible and could never happen. So obviously it could happen. So how rare it is not an issue of concern for us. The fact of the matter is it can happen. And when it does happen, then the question arises, what's the outcome? Is this tshuva mullah? Sorry? And the Rambam says that it is. It is the guide to try and understand. I mean, it's a chiddush. Little holy Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, right? It's a chiddush. So, because you would think, no. You would think that it's too late. So, Kamash Malan, that it's Moab. That itself really deserves a little further analysis of trying to understand it. Why? Why a person can ask the question and say, what do you mean? Okay, we'll return to that, but I just want to get to the Rambam Hilchos Tshuva, third step. So the Rambam talks about the Tov, the good, Atzuna, Atova, Atzuna, Watadika. That's how he refers to the ultimate reward. The good that is hidden. It's a hidden one. It's hidden because it's something which we can't really relate to. The type of good the Torah promises us is not something that we can relate to in our present condition. We can't imagine what it's like. And most people, when they think about a reward, are are looking for something that they can, you know, think about, fantasize about, something which lies somewhere within the realm of imagination. What the realm is saying is it just lies outside the realm of imagination. There's no way you can conceive in any way of what it's like. He says, the Talavah HaTzun HaLachadikim, the good that is hidden for Tadikim, the Chaye HaOlam Haba, that is the life of Olam Haba, that is the life of the world to come. Is he now? Now, of course, when I say to come, meaning it's not in the present state. It's going to be, you know, in the non-present state. Let's use the term future. Does that mean at some future point in time in our context, in history? In other words, i.e., the Melech HaMashiach, is that the Olam Haba? Or is it something else? Well, that's because there are those. The Ramban maintains that the Yemot HaMashiach is essentially synonymous with Olam Haba, with Kriya Samaritan, and that really constitutes the ultimate reward. So the Ramban has a totally different position. And that is the life in which does not partake of death. It's interesting the way you express it. What does he say, Sha'ain Babas in Lion? What does he mean by that? Why does he express it that way? He simply says, you don't die.
Yeah.
You don't die. There's two ways I can conceive of a situation in which there's no death. But for example, in physical life, in this world, in other words, if it's the will of God, God can prolong my existence from ad infinitum, forever, whatever you want to say. But that's one way it's subject to death. In other words, this type of existence that we have is one which is mother to mother. By its very character, it's subject to death. It's not an accident to themselves. It's a given. It's part of the nature of the situation. But don't think that in Olam Haba, it's just a quantitative difference. In other words, there you live, but then, you know, it doesn't end. It keeps going. That's not the pshat. It's Ein Mavet Yomayim, which means to say is that by its very character, it's not subject to death. That's what he's telling you, it's a different kind of existence. It's in the very character of the existence that it is not subject to death. That Talavah She'ein Marah, he says the same thing. That it is the good which does not carry with it any ra, any evil. Isolated, it's not a pure good. It's always got pain associated with it. Any pleasure that you have in this world is always associated with many things. The only thing is, when we refer to something as being good, the mind is always weighing both factors. It's a trade-off. It's always a trade-off. So you say that this, you have a good job. I have a good job. And if, last year I had a bad job. When you say bad job, it doesn't mean that every element, every aspect of it was bad. It just means on the whole that the bad outweighs the good, to an extent that I really can't take it. When you say good, do you mean that everything about it, I would probe, I would question, you find a lot of things you don't like about it? So yeah, of course, but you have to, that's life. I mean, you can't expect that it should be purely good. And the same is true about everything. I mean, every pleasure that you indulge in this world has its downside. Eating, drinking, this kind of dreadful, then that there's dangers to it, you know, overweighting it to it. Other pains, and then afterwards you feel full. I mean, I don't have to describe. It's pretty obvious to everyone. And that's in the best situations. If a person falls madly in love, whatever it is, I mean, it's never just a good, purely good. It's always, hopefully, a good life is one in which the good outweighs the bad. But you can't say that it's any more raw. It's impossible. This life, I mean, there's loss. Every good contains a loss. I mean, if you get very attached. An individual, you have a great friend. So that already carries a certain debt with it, because then there's going to be pain when the person has to leave you, or if the person dies. I mean, it's impossible. Any good you're going to partake of in this world is going to have pain with it. So that's what he means, that again, it's a totally different type of existence. It's a totally type of different type of existence. That factor, in other words, that element which is responsible for that which we regard as raw in this world will totally be absent in the world to come. The question now arises, where is the Olam Haba mentioned in the Gemara? The Piyashmua Lamdu. In other words, this is not the obvious meaning. of the Sukkim. But the idea is referred to in the Sukkim, and it's known as Piyashmur. It's known as Piyashmur, meaning it's from the Masorah. From the Masorah. Well, yeah, because the plain meaning of the Sukkim do not speak about it. It's a good catch of why the plain meaning of the Sukkim. The Piyashmur Lamdu, we learn from the Masorah, Laman Yitavlach. It says Laman Yitavlach. La'olam shekulo tov. L'man yitavlach, in order that it will be good to you. Interesting. Where is it referred to? By Shiloh HaKan. Interesting. Why is it referred to?
Mitzvah Kala.
Mitzvah Kala.
That's what
it means. Yeah, it's mentioned in some places. So it says, familiar when you come to people. When you encounter a bird's nest, okay, and you want to take the mother, so you have to send away the chicks. You have to send away the mother. And you take the chicks. In order that it will be good for you, two things are stated here. It will be good for you, and you will have length of days. Okay? So Chazal say that this is not a reference to this world, life in this world, but it's a reference to the ultimate reward. The man Yitavlach, and that's the story of the Ramah. La'olam shekuroto, a world which is completely good, inherently good. That is to say, that's the point, that it doesn't contain any evil with it. V'ha'arachta yamin, and you will have length of days, la'olam shekuroto. Olam Shekulah, it's in the very nature of the thing, that it's eternal. A world is eternal. That's different. In other words, they're living a long time in a world which is not eternal. V'zehu ha'olam haba. And this is what we refer to as the world to come. The world to come, according to the Rambam, is a, first of all, it's not historical. To come over here, the future over here does not mean the future in a time sense, in a historical sense. See, it means relative to this. Olam Haba, in other words, does Olam Haba exist right now? Yes. According to the Rambam, yes, it existed it's part of creation, it existed from day one.
Another world.
It's a different dimension of the soul. It's a different dimension of the soul. In other words, that the existence of the soul in its physical form, that's Olam Hazeh. After death, when the soul is removed from its relationship to the physical, you see, it exists in a different state, that's Olam Haba. So Ba to come means, you know, chronologically, this existence, physical existence, precedes the existence of the soul when it's unrelated to the physical. But that means to say that Adam HaRishon was already, the phenomenon of Olam Haba exists as soon as man is created. It's part of the nature of creation. Man by nature is a creature who is designed to exist in that type of a state. You see? So it's just referred to as Olam Haba, you know, in a practical way. It seems that this idea, the idea of Olam Haba, is being referred to in the Torah. So the question is, if so, why isn't it stated more directly? Why is it only stated in a way where the Torah, it means that that's not the plain shot. The plain shot is that the reward of the mitzvah will be really good for you. You'll have a good life and a long life in this world. That's plenty. And the Piyash Mu'alamdu, that it contains, it's a reference to a different idea as well. That it's not just length of days in this world, but it means it's a reference to Olam Shekulo, Tov Olam Shekulo. So, I mean, you could ask the question, why didn't the Torah make it more explicit? Something, of course, which is, this is one of the Yisodei Hadas. It's one of the Yisodos. A person who's kofar, a person who's kofar in Olam Haba, kofar b'ikar. You see? So, but, in spite of that, it's not referred to in an open type of a way. See the same thing with regard to Mashiach. The Rambam quotes Sukkim to prove the idea of Mashiach, but it's, again, these Sukkim are not, in terms of their, it's a reference, only because you can see Ashmur, but it's not, in other words, if we didn't have the idea from the Masorah, of the Mashiach, then we wouldn't really know about from the Torah. So I'm in Alach Ahei now. Perek Tes Alach Ahei in Tshuva. Now that's the reward of the tzaddikim. Okay? Hanakama, she'enakama gadol imena, the revenge, for which there is no revenge greater, she'tikaris hanefesh, the soul is cut off, below tzaka, la'otan hachayim, and does not merit that life, she'nema, he'tikaris hanefesh ahi, that soul shall be cut off, the double expression, avona ba, it's sin, is in it. Mizeh ha'avadam husha karen osan ha'avim derech moshel be'er shacha, and so on and so forth. In other words, the Rambam is saying, he said this before, by the way, he says it in Halacha Aleph, he says the same thing. Let's go back to where I left off in the entire Shemini. Shara tzadikim husha Yisku with Noam Zeh. The reward of the tzaddikim is that they merit this Noam, this pleasantness. V'yihu b'tov hazu, and they will be in this. V'yihu meaning to say that's a condition. They'll be in that condition of Olam Haba. U'piron ha'rashayim, and the payment, the punishment of the Rashayim who shalo yisku l'chayim elu, is that they will not be zochah to this life. Ela yichrasu v'yamutu, it's death. In other words, everything boils down to simple terms, life or death. That's it. The purpose of man is to merit life, essentially. But life, of course, is in two contexts, in two frameworks. First of all, there's life in this world. And again, most people make the mistake of making this world the essential. Everything, the only, it's a very important psychological point. The only thing they can relate to is when they think of the good and happiness and everything, it's all in this world. As I said, the Torah doesn't deny it that there's a good in this world, but in your mind's eye, you have to bear in mind that there's a perspective that this world is a prosa. If a person focuses all his energy on the prosa, on the antechamber, he's going to lose out on the ultimate good. I give the mashal that he gave, I mean, give many mashalim. Because the person is on, it helps the person, by the way, get through this life. Because the bumps and, setbacks in this world become much easier to take. They become exceedingly difficult to take, and the person imagines that this is all that he has, that he can relate to. This is the only good, and then he can't tolerate failure in this world. And the person has a different perspective. He realizes that the purpose over here is not to pleasure, but the purpose over here is to prepare himself. Haske and asmucha. He says, of course, there is a phenomenon of having a good life in this world, but if he doesn't have all the things that he would like in this world, he doesn't bother that much because he realizes that they're not worth that much anyway. But the person is going on a trip. So he stays at motels along the way, and his mind's eye, but he's really focused on getting to it. The destination, this beautiful resort that his life is going to get there. That's the mashal. So, along the way, it's going to take 10 days to get there. Along the way, he'd like that pleasant traveling, but he stops off in the motel, and it's basically okay, basically convenient, but certain things, there's certain extra luxuries aren't there, or there's enough fresh flowers here. If he's only going to be there overnight, he's not going to start to go crazy and make a whole big tumult and be depressed about it, because it doesn't matter that much. Of course, when he gets to the ultimate destination, that's where he expects everything to be perfect. You follow? But people treat the way people live their lives is as though, you see, they're taking that temporary situation, the motel, and then they're treating it as though everything over there has to be perfect, and they can't tolerate if it's not. It's funny. This is exactly, they're switching it around. They're relating to this world as though this world is the palace. This is the ultimate good. This is where everything has to be. If it's not working out over here, they're going crazy. But if you look at it in a different context, you see, that everything in this world, the physical world, is essentially, that's part of the Rambam we work on, that the purpose of all physical existence is to create an opportunity for man to perfect himself and relate to the ultimate good. And the real arena of the ultimate good is not in this world. Although it is good, a person's ashrecha. Ashrecha v'tavla. Ashrecha v'olam hazeh. You have the best existence in this world. You see, that's what the Rambam is saying, that the ultimate reward is not to be found in this world, and the ultimate punishment, the ultimate reward, of course, is life, is real life, true life. That's it. Once a person is zochah to the true life, he partakes of the ultimate good. That's the eternal, and it's the most perfect type of existence that we can aspire to. Of course, people can't relate to it because they can only relate to externals. You know, people can think. I mean, when a person thinks of the good, he thinks of things. You know, things, wealth, money, you know, objects. There's no objects over here. But it's very, very hard. I mean, it doesn't fit. It doesn't make an impact on the psyche of man, I mean, any part of man. It's not appealing. It's not appealing because it's just something you can't even relate to. So what's the punishment? It makes sense. Well, what's the punishment? The punishment is the loss of the good. I mean, that's anything greater than that. What's the punishment? What do you see? We the difficulty with this because again we're using our own categories. It's our own emotion. We speak. We want to rush it to suffer. We want to punish him. We want to get even with him, and so on and so forth. Yeah, that's it. It's an emotion. But the real punishment means to be cut off from the good, deprived from the good. That there can't be any greater punishment than that. That's the Rambam says over here. The Rambam says over here that the way this operates, I mean, it's more or less it's built into the laws of nature, that the soul, man has within him the potential. He has an element within him which has the potential. It all depends upon how he utilizes his bechira. If he directs his energy, he creates an attachment to the world of the truth, the world of the abstract beyond the physical, so then that has an effect upon the soul, because we're using terms here, descriptive terms. And that soul, which has been separated from the physical, and becomes attached somehow to the world of the eternal, it becomes eternal. That soul, which has associated itself and become attached to the world of the physical, becomes part of the physical. And when the physical dies, it dies with it. And that's the way it is. I mean, of course, that's a description. You can't go beyond, you know, why this and why that. You can't treat it like a medical phenomenon because you don't have these. You're dealing with something which is not. It's a metaphysical phenomenon. But these are the results of the Torah tells us. We have from the Masoja. This is basically what's happening over here. What he says is perfect. Being cut off from the good is death, even if he's physically doing it. It's Chazal for that. That Tzadikim, the Mishasan, Kuyin Kayim, Tzadikim in their death are referred to as being alive. And Rishayim Bechayehem, Kuyin Mesh. That Rishayim in their life are referred to as dead. I mean, really, in all practical purposes, he's dead. It's just physically breathing and whatever. That's not really life. Life means to partake of existence, of true existence. And true existence for man is not the physical. Because true existence is measured by the character of the being you're talking about. So, you know, for a bird, that's its existence. Its existence is to function as a bird. That's its existence. But for man, its existence is to function as a talent with him. Which is to say, the life of the mind, the life of the neshama. Now, when you cut yourself off from that, you're basically dead. For all practical purposes, you're dead. More because what existence do you have? But as long as the game, so to speak, is not over, you can be tshuva. You can return to existence. You can return to existence. But if he does not do, but when the game is over, when he dies, and he did not do tshuva, then that's it. There's no difference really. There's no difference between a Russian when he's alive and when he's dead, except with regard to the harms and for other people. One is a yid gimel ikar, right? One is a yid gimel ikar. The person is kofer, and one is it's the principle of Torah. It's not just of course it's a fact of reality, but it's the principle of Torah and Torah belief. The person is kofer and all of us, so he's kofer to Torah and he's kofer. Ein lo chelek. The idea of the Rambam brings down. That the ultimate punishment of the Russia is cursed. That is to say, it essentially means death. It's the death of the end of existence. It's the death of the body. Well, the physical was temporary anyway, but man has within him the divine soul. So he has something which is capable of eternal existence. And that all depends upon how the person lives his life. In other words, if he directs himself towards the source of good, of all good, if he directs himself towards the love of truth and the love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then it has an effect upon his soul. And the soul continues to exist even when it's separated from the body. And the punishment of the Rasha is simply that he doesn't partake of that eternal existence. So that's something which a lot of people find troubling. What's troubling is because we have our own, it's true, but the troubling is that we have our own idea of punishment. It's not something which appeals to the human emotions, because we view punishment in a certain way, and the way we view punishment essentially is the deprivation of the physical. Not just the deprivation of the physical, but physical torture, physical torment. That's the context in which we view it. So therefore there is a certain idea that everybody has, especially if a person himself is abiding by the rules. If a person is abiding by the rules, so then it's very troubling to him when other people get away with it. Because, you know, we have that in many situations. It's like if you're taking a test, so you're not going to cheat. But then you notice that there's somebody else that's cheating. So now you have to be very honest about your emotions. What are your true emotions about this person being caught? Now, of course, if this person is caught and he's a friend of yours, you're going to express your sympathy. But it seems to me that if you're honest, there's a certain ambivalence over there. On a certain level, it's going to bother you, quite the contrary. It's going to bother you if this person is not caught. And if the person is caught, then you won't express it. You see, people are not entirely honest about their emotions. There's a certain ambivalence over here. But how do you explain that? I mean, I think it's true that if the person is caught, there's a certain satisfaction. Although you never say it. It depends, of course. Depends on a lot of factors, but assuming that this is a friend of yours, you know, if this person is a friend of yours and you spent the last few months killing yourself, giving up all the pleasures and studying, and the other person was just indulging himself and like, yeah, don't worry about it, I'll get by. And it turns out that he's got this little system and he's doing it, and you're aware of it, and you're going to watch it with a different type of an attitude. What's that? He's copying from you. Yeah. Now the question is, I maintain that I'm talking about emotions, so you can't speak for everybody. I think it's a pretty general thing though. I think in a general sense there would be a certain satisfaction if this person is caught, and I think on a general sense there'd be a certain unhappiness or a disappointment if you got away with it. Emotion. You gotta be honest. What's the nature of that emotion? Why? Because this is just perhaps one of the greatest pleasures, secret pleasures of people. That is, the other guy getting caught. The other guy getting caught is a secret. No one can talk about it, but it's a hot topic in shul. And that's part of the Lashon Hara. It's a hot topic. It's the latest scandal. I mean, somebody else got caught in a scam, and everybody's got to know about it. Oh, so there's exactly. It's in the newspapers. Yeah. I think an analogous situation would be, this happens all the time. You're in a store, you're waiting online, or you go to the motor vehicle bureau where you really have to wait online, and everybody's looking for the angle. You know, because that's one of the biggest, annoyances. It's one of those annoyances of modern living. And what do? You're stuck on the line, you're waiting your turn, every 5 minutes you move up 2 inches. Then another guy comes in, has this clever thing, they're not looking, and he just sneaks in front of the line, and he's like, Now, people again will be ambivalent. You know, some people might respond, might react. Other people are sort of like they don't want to make a fuss, but it can be extremely bothersome to them if he gets away with it. And the other end, if he's caught, they're going to be very, very relieved, so to speak, if the guy's caught. Now, don't say it's because. Don't explain to us because he's causing you to wait longer. What's that? I'll tell you why. It's not that he has to wait longer. I'll tell you why. Because it's more than that. Because let's assume that it really doesn't make much difference. Either let's assume that you're way back there, and this guy gets taken care of very quickly, so the whole thing is like 2 minutes. Okay, and he's finished already. So it only cost you 2 minutes anyway. But on the way out, let's assume now, imagine on the way out, somebody noticed in court and they take away his papers and he has to go, as a punishment. Then you'd be extremely satisfied. Also, let's assume that you're right behind him. So it doesn't make a difference to you anyway. You're just about to be taken care of. So this is another delay of a minute or two. It doesn't really make a difference, practically. Still in all, you follow? Still in all, it's going to have an effect upon you. But I'm maintaining that even on the way out, when it's no longer a factor, it would, most people would be extremely happy if somebody caught the guy, caught him and made him go back to the very end of the line and start all over again, or even if they added a penalty to it, you see, and made him sit in a box for 15 minutes just found to punish him. So, getting back to the question of the Rambam is quite, from an emotional standpoint, dissatisfying in the concept of the ultimate punishment, because it seems that it's not what we expect. We expect the rush to really get paid back in the way we would understand it, to really get tortured, and bigger the rush, the greater the torture. But for the Rambam, it doesn't seem to be that way. But basically, he loses the good, which is serious. Right, we're happy about that. Makes us very happy. But it's not satisfying enough from an emotional standpoint. So we're just discussing the idea that apparently what we're doing over here is we're projecting a certain emotional attitude that we have towards other people's misdeeds onto the whole phenomenon of the Torah's concept of Kavionis. And I'm just saying, as a workup, I want to explain the phenomenon that it seems that people who basically obey the law have a certain attitude towards those who are cheating. I said, if you're totally honest, if you're taking the test and you've worked very, very hard and you're scrupulous and you're not cheating, and then you notice that there is an individual who is cheating, then I would say that if you're totally honest from an emotional standpoint, you're very upset if he gets away with it, and if the guy, you wouldn't snitch on the person because that bothers you too. So therefore, you're ambivalent. It bothers you. You can't snitch because that would make you feel guilty. On the other hand, if this person is caught, people won't admit it, but that's one of their greatest fears. So that would be very, very satisfying to end up discussing the court. And now the question is why? Why are you happy that somebody else got caught? I mean, it doesn't profit you at all. You don't get any profit from it. Nor do you lose anything by the fact that you're cheating. If you tell me honest, what you lose, I assume that you're doing the correct thing because you determine that is the correct thing to do. So what difference is correct whether the other guy is doing it or not doing it? Yet it would bother you very, very much if the person gets away with it. Now the question is why? Teddy's suggesting that when someone else gets caught, you're really happy because this confirms that you're doing the right thing. Now, I don't understand that. How does this confirm that you're doing the right thing? Because let's assume then if you're going to maintain that, if you're going to maintain that, then you're going to have to maintain the opposite, which is a very troubling idea. That is, if he's not caught, if he gets away with it, then maybe you're not doing the right thing. Then maybe you should shoot it. But I don't think you would change your position. In other words, what would you say? Let's say the other person cheated and got away with it. Would you then question whether you did the right thing or not? I think that I assume that the question, of course, would be, why is it that you're not cheating? Why is it that you're taking the test in an honest way? Is it because you believe that that's what's best, the correct thing to do? So then, it's the correct thing to do, whether others are doing it or not. And if others are doing it, whether they're caught or not, is really irrelevant to you. On the other hand, if you're not sure, so why are you being honest in the first place? You have to decide. I assume you've made a decision as to what the right thing is. Now, I don't see to what extent that decision has to do with what happens to other people who take a different position on this question. That's my problem. In certain situations, this can lead to violence. Because, it all depends upon what the context is. See, in a test, you have to understand there's a difference between waiting online and everybody taking a test. If you're taking a test, this cheating doesn't affect your situation at all, basically.
Well,
very, 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 very remotely. Because the fact that it has nothing to do with it.
Well,
it's not going to make your test any more difficult, you see. It may, in a certain sense,
occur.
Okay, but let's say it's not occur. Basically, you see the difference. In the other case, it's directly affecting you because you have to wait longer. Okay, but I've shown you some examples that that's not what bothers you. Because even if it turns out that it didn't make much difference, the amount of emotion that you have is not, is very, very strong. if it affects you a great, in certain situations, it can lead to violence. I mean, like in traffic, people get into big fights and shooting.
Absolutely.
If somebody cut off another guy in a car, you're waiting on a line, there's an accident, and everybody's waiting, and, you know, it's being directed. And if somebody that just cuts them from the side, it could really trigger off very strong emotions. And it's basically the same thing, though. And there, too, it's basically the same thing, and the amount of delay that he's caused you may not be that great. So what is the root of this? One is making the point that people tend to criticize others for the faults, defects that they themselves have.
Exactly.
I realize that. It's an amazing thing. I never, it's such an altruistic thing. It would be like a doctor is involved, he has a disease, and others have a disease, and he uses his knowledge to cure others when he could be curing himself. Isn't that amazing? You say this is pathetic. And yet in this area, we since we have the same disease, and others have the disease, I mean, it's an interesting thing about human nature. We're very altruistic. We spend our time criticizing others, not thankfully, of course, to help them, while we could be using that time and energy to work on ourselves and make ourselves better people.
Right. Yeah.
How altruistic is man to criticize others? Brown says that the primary obligation of a person is to correct himself, to perfect himself,
absolutely,
because that's where you have the control. That's where you have the ability. Each person is commanded. Then he says there are certain people that reach the Madrega where they can perfect themselves, but they can't perfect others. Because that requires a higher degree, you know, abilities and insight and so forth. Then he says that there are certain people that have the capacity to correct themselves and to effectuate perfection in others as well. That's the highest level. You know, those are the teachers, moral leaders, and so on and so forth. Yeah, but primarily everybody, first has to work on himself.
Right.
People that go off and they're trying to save the world when they haven't reached the point of any type of perfection or maturity, it's just a crazy idea, it's an unsensical idea. It's impossible to help others until you've really perfected yourself. Gary is absolutely correct. I mean, I don't want you to think about it, but you can disagree with me. And that is, when this reaction occurs, there's a certain, like, envy and aggression, because that's precisely what you want to do. That precisely each person would love to beat the system. Nobody wants to, some things will free. Nobody wants to play by the rules. Everybody wants to be free to run around, have fun, stay up late, watch TV, then come in the next day and pass the test. But you can't do that. So therefore you have to submit to the rules. Now that is something which people find troubling. Everybody has this rebelliousness is pretty innate in human nature, the instinctual part of man. So the only reason that he does it, and a person should be totally honest about this, now, what's the real reason that he does it? Here's where the difficulty emerges. Why, primarily speaking, most people play by the rules because of fear. Because of fear. Exactly, fear of being caught, fear of the system. You're not strong enough to buck the system. That's basically what it is. What? Correct, by the way. What they were saying is true. There's a certain recognition that if everybody were to do it, you couldn't function. But that's not what motivates the individual, because he always feels, yeah, now that everybody's playing by the rules, so then it's not going to destroy the whole thing if I break it. You see what I'm saying? What you're saying is true. But that's not what motivates the individual, because you know that the system is going to prevail. So if you don't hold from cutting the line, because philosophically speaking, if that's the case, if everybody were to do that, then it's just not the case. It's not going to make a difference. Those types of things don't affect you. That's not the reason why people vote. You vote, and it's a good point to be made many times. What difference is your answer? Why vote? I mean, your vote will not make a difference in the presidential election. So then they say, well, if everybody thought that way, that's fine. You know, if everybody thought that way, then nobody would vote. That's true. But everybody doesn't think that way. Why should I vote? People don't vote because of that philosophical concept. There's another reason. Anyway, getting back to this case, I would say that essentially that a person really is submitting. And that's on one level, of course. A person who's perfected and his actions are based upon a love of justice per se, and he recognizes to act this way would be false and it would be an unjust thing and be harming his soul, that person would not react this way, because whatever somebody else is doing would not in any way elicit that emotion in him, wouldn't be troubling to him, and in fact he might be sympathetic to him. His attitude towards the other person would be sympathetic. He doesn't really care whether the person is caught or not caught. I mean, it's irrelevant to him. Therefore, if he has a reaction to the other person, it's because what happens to him is very relevant. It's very relevant to him, because the only reason that he's doing it is because of this fear. He hasn't overcome this desire. He still has a desire to get away with it. The only thing is that desire is being suppressed by the fear. So if everybody now follows the system, so that's the system, that's reality, I can accept it. I'm not a fool. Everybody wants to be that special person who gets away with it, who breaks the rules. Everybody wants to be like him. You see? So that's why, if he gets away with it, that troubles you. He did it, that's exactly what I want, he didn't get caught. So emotionally, you feel cheated. That's why when this person tries to beat the system and he gets caught, then there's a tremendous relief. In terms of yourself. That you're not a fool. You didn't, in other words, it bothers you because that's exactly what you would like to do, but you don't have the guts to do it, and the way you justify it is because it's impossible and it's justice and all that. But when you see that it's doable, so then it brings home to mind that you just didn't have the guts to do it. So therefore, when the guy is caught, that reaffirms that's just a crazy thing to do. I'm not going to act crazily. In other words, is it what your own view of yourself? Is it that basically you're a weak guy, you're a weak person, and you're afraid to take a chance? Or no, you act correctly, you act intelligently, it's consistent, it's absurd, it's suicide. And when you see that it's doable and another guy gets away with it, and that's exactly what you wanted to do, and it's troubling to you, it's bothering you. You see, it's doable, you see, so then you're a fool. You know, you're one of the flippers, you stand on line. That's why, however, if a person has made a decision of what's right and what's wrong, and there are, for example, like stealing. Well, stealing also, you wouldn't steal. You wouldn't steal. But if somebody else steals, you see the same thing. You see the same thing, and that is to say, if he steals and gets away with it, it's very troubling to a person. Crime doesn't pay. That's very important to people. Now, that shows you that to a large extent, the reason why people are behaving in a moral way is not that after the fact they decide to take something which is a necessity and make a virtue out of it. Making a virtue out of necessity. You understand what I'm talking about? In other words, you're making a virtue because now that you're doing it, you need compensation. Now that you're making a sacrifice, you're sacrificing an instinctual desire. And that instinctual desire is to take somebody else's stuff. Whether it be on cheating on a test, it's all the same thing. It's a form of gezel, like some learning phrase. It's a form of stealing. It's it. Without earning it. That is a very powerful greed. It's a very powerful psychological desire. Now, we relinquish it. Now, why do we relinquish it? Truth is, because of necessity. But that's deflating to man's ego, man's narcissism. He doesn't want to look himself as that type of being. Where's the payback? So therefore, he now gets a payback by elevating himself. And what is the payback? I am a moral person. I'm a high-level individual. I'm a moral person. So he creates this identity of being a moral person. Now, if you're a truly moral person who believes in the good and this is the correct way to act, then in and of itself, that the good is its own reward. If that's the case, you're being rewarded right now. What do you care whether this guy's caught or not? He's a fool. He's harming himself. If you should have that reaction, then that would indicate that no, that you have not, to a certain extent, you still partake of that emotion. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I mean, all these things are matters of degree. I mean, because certain things are very powerful emotions, and you just might feel that emotion. The fact that you feel that emotion momentarily doesn't mean that you haven't achieved any level of morality. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that should indicate something to you. Because you may feel the emotion, then you think it over, and you say, it's ridiculous. Why would I, See, but there's no reason that most people won't react to that. Most people would have no sympathy for that person also. Well, they'd have no sympathy. Because since they were involved and they were waiting on the line, there's a huge amount of aggression against this person. Yeah, you're right, it's a blow. Why should he get away with it, is the feeling. It's a blow to your narcissism. Because each person wants, that's exactly what you want to be, the person that doesn't have to play by the rules. That's the ego of man. That's a criminal. And a criminal doesn't want to play by the rules. He wants to, naturally to be able to enjoy all the things that he wants without having to work, without having to submit to the laws of reality. That's what a criminal is. Sociopath, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, but I'm saying that we all partake of that to a certain extent. And the first level of morality, of course, is based upon fear. Without fear, I mean, there's got to be fear. That's one of the problems about contemporary society. The Rambam has the mitzvah of fearing God on the first level. The first level of the mitzvah, the Rambam of fearing God, is a person must inculcate within himself this idea that God exists, and we're not hefker, so to speak. It's not free. It's not a free world where you can do whatever you please. And that is to say that the God exists and God takes cognizance of everything that happens, and God rewards and God punishes. That's the nature of the universe that you're living in. And that's essential. That's not the highest level of fear, by the way. That's not the highest level of serving God. That's why that's, yeah, but that's the lower, exactly. That's what the Rambam calls serving out of fear. It's the lowest level, but if you uproot that from the world and you cannot proceed, the world isn't going to be in chaos. Without the fear of God, the world will be in chaos. And that is seen in our contemporary society today. I mean, over the last, the last couple of centuries, there's been a steady erosion, breakdown of so-called religious attitudes. The loss of a fear, there's no fear. And yet, Baharoguni al Bharishti. That was all, even with Avimelech, Pharaoh was a low level instinctual society. Avimelech was a much more advanced individual. He was a high level person, but it wasn't based upon a fear of God. So Avraham said, in a society where there's no fear of God, even if it's advanced, they're animals, higher level animals, they're capable of anything. Again, so Matt is saying that there's another idea, and that is that we're taught this idea that if you play by the system, you'll succeed. That's the best way to go. Of course, every system has to justify itself that way, and no doubt it's true. And in a general sense. But the fact that it's not working in this case, why should that bother you so much? Let's face it. You need to tell me because somebody who cut you on the line in the motor vehicle field, that's showing that the whole system is in there. It doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. Why is it producing this reaction? It can't be that. Because, again, if that's the case, very well, any intelligent person knows very well that no system is perfect. Everyone's going to get away with it. There are cases where a person gets away with it. But on the whole, If a guy robs a bank and gets away with it, that's not going to change. You're not going to say, well, maybe I should rob a bank. It's not the case. I mean, on the whole, the basic idea is that that's not a way to go. So I agree with you that's the way these things are reinforced. But it's much more significant than that. It's much more significant. It bothers you emotionally. It bothers you emotionally, I'd say, because of that factor. There's a tremendous aggression. There's aggression against that person. If you want to beat that person up, there's an aggression against that particular person. So it's not just an abstract thing. It's because all their frustration is directed against him because he's doing exactly what they want to do. If they did not have that desire, then it wouldn't produce that reaction. Because in truth, he didn't really do much harm to them. That's what I'm saying. That's why I just wanted to prove the point. That's why when we take up the issue of Olam Haba, we have to be very careful. The reason why a lot of things are difficult is because we're applying this type of a concept to a different situation. That the punishment of the Rasha. The Rambam means that true punishment, that there's no purpose. There's no purpose in simply afflicting pain on an individual. The only true punishment. What is the punishment of physical pain? Physical pain is not an evil in and of itself. It's not evil in and the truth of the matter is like this. This may sound harsh, but I don't mean it that way. Because of course we have sympathy for anyone who's suffering. We have to understand where I'm coming from. But if a person is living a life of physical pain, is that really in and of itself an evil? Now, I would say it makes a difference. It depends. If the person is essentially living an instinctual existence, he does not partake of the good. He's living like an animal, so to speak, for all intents and purposes. So then the only thing that the physical pain does is prevent him from engaging in physical pleasure, which is not his true purpose. So then the physical pain is not serving to deter him from his purpose. So there's no real evil. Because there's no difference between a state of existence when he's in a state of physical pain or when he's in a state of physical pleasure. Because we don't accord physical pleasure the status of being a value or a good in and of itself. It's only a good because it produces a situation in which man can partake of the good, which is to be involved in the world of knowledge and then Ahavas Hashem. If a person is engaged in the real good and the pursuit of his true purpose, then mishaps occur which deter him from his purpose, so that's a deflection, that's a problem, that's an evil. To disturb the sleep of a bank robber, keep him awake all night, is not an evil. To disturb the sleep of a Talmud Chacham and therefore make it impossible for him to study the next day, that's the worst wishes. That is evil. So it's not disturbing sleep per se. We're not taking physical things per se. Evil is measured in terms of the deflection of the individual from his true purpose. That's the only evil, the loss of the purpose. And then physical suffering is bad only because it prevents him from fulfilling his purpose. So, as the Ram says, that's the ultimate karma. What's the ultimate karma? Well, it's a pain. Pain per se doesn't mean anything. The ultimate karma is the loss of the good. That's the real punishment. That's the way it turns out then. There can't be any nekama in this is subjecting someone to physical pain. That doesn't mean anything. But the ultimate nekama is with regard to the good. That is the only way. In other words, the reward and the punishment have to go hand in hand. The ultimate good is life of Olam Haba. Now, what could be worse than the loss of that good? That's the ultimate nekama. That's the Rambam's position. And anything else, you, we don't find this emotionally satisfying because of the fact that to us we're relating to everything in dealing with physical pain, and we partake of that to a certain extent. That the good is really physical, and we're not going to be satisfied until our emotions are satisfied. This person really stayed depressed emotionally on the emotional standpoint, but the Rambam spoke from a different standpoint because the whole thing is set up with regard to the ultimate purpose of man. And with regard to the ultimate purpose of man, God set up the world in such a way that man can be zochet, to do the proper use of his bechira, can be zochet to the ultimate good, and when he fails to do it and lives improperly, then he suffers the ultimate harm, which is the loss of Olam Haba. That's the Rambam system. A good Eitza. This is a practical Eitza. Wherever I go, I always take more than a safer or a book, something to think about. So something, you know, then whenever, if that's the case, then you're never really waiting. Like you're waiting for an airplane. It's a very painful emotion to wait. Waiting is like a painful emotion. You say, yeah, but a person that's involved in thought is not waiting. He's not waiting. Waiting means to say, because it's just, you're really suspending your energy. You can't do anything. But you're living in a state of suspended energy is very, very painful. You'd like to do things, but you can't. Yeah, but if a person's involved in an idea, so then it's just, that's accidental, where he's moving. The line moving, not moving, is really not bothering him. Because he's totally having the satisfaction of being involved in an idea. He's not really truly waiting. The person who's waiting is the person who's standing there with nothing to do. And that's the pain. I can't wait till I have a chance to do anything. Not that he'll be doing anything anyways, or something important. So usually it's, oh, you know, when he finally gets there, so now, okay, well, who cares? What are you going to do now? But that's not the point. The point is that in his own mind, he's suspended from his life. He can't stand the idea of being suspended from his life. Yeah, but the person is involved in thinking, so he's totally involved now. It's an accident that he has to be on the line. That's not, he doesn't define himself as being in a state of waiting.